Life is too short for shit books. That's the mantra of The Book Alchemist, and I'm your host, Heather Sutty. In this episode, we meet the legendary Scottish journalist, Billy Sloane, who for 50 years has been writing about music. He's recently published his own memoir, One Life, One Love, and we talk about music, boxing, books, and so much more. Billy, congratulations on One Life, One Love.
Thank you very much. It's been a long time coming, something like, 45 years, but it's finally here and the reaction to it seems to be great. So fingers crossed that continues.
Yay. Any plans to write another book?
I've just written this one. You know, it took 6 months out of my life, but I've been kind of having a think about it. You know, I don't know if there's another one in the same format as, One Love, One Life, but I'll wait until the dust settles and then I'll sort of reevaluate. And if I think, I can write about something else. It was good fun to do. It was just good to get all the stories in a book all in the one place at the one time, just for me as a kind of record of what I've done over the past 45 years. And it was good for my family, my son and my daughter and stuff. So it was good just to sort of have it in a kind of tangible form rather than it just all existing in my head.
It's a great read. Now tell me about all the stories that didn't make the book.
Oh, there was a few, and the only reason they didn't make the book was just because it was, space restrictions. I was asked for somewhere between 80 and 100,000 words and I actually turned in 110,000 words. And Black and White, the publishers in Edinburgh, who've been great, said, you're 10,000 words over, we need to get it down a bit, you need to cut it down. So there was a whole chapter on a subject which didn't really fit. And I thought, well, if I get rid of that, that's 3,000 words right away. And then I started kind of chipping away at it. So I got about 5,000 words out of it. And then that was as good as I could get it. And then, of course, the boss of Black and White says, oh, you need to tell this story and that story and this story. I says, well, if I do that, that's another 500. That just bumps it up. So the compromise was it was about 10,500 words. And, it was just because of space. But, there was great stories in it. Like, there was a story about one time I went down to Drummond to interview Wet, Wet, Wet. And Marty Pell at the time was living in a wee cottage in Drummond. So we went down there to interview the band because they had a new album coming out or something. So, of course, we took them down onto the banks of the loch and it was Alistair Devine, who was the photographer, who you'll know. And he did these amazing pictures of the guy standing in what looked like a shortbread packet. And then they said, we're a bit hungry. We might get something to eat. It was about 5:30. So we walked into Drummond and there was one Chinese restaurant called, the Bamboo Palace or something like that. And I went in and the girl was sort of fixing the tables. And I says, have you got a table for six, the four guys from Wet, Wet, Wet and me and Alistair? She went, oh, we don't open for another hour yet. It's only 5:30. We don't open till 6:30. And I said, but, we're just going to come in and have something to eat. We're not going to sit for ages. Can we knock it? No, we don't open for another hour. I says, well, I've got a famous pop group outside. Does that make any difference? And she went, who is it? And I went, it's Wet, Wet, Wet. And she went, yeah, sure. And although she was Chinese, she was kind of Scottish Chinese. She had a Scottish Glasgow accent. And she says, where are they? I said, they're standing outside. So we walked outside in the street and there was the four members of the band and Alistair standing. And she looked at them and said, that's no Wet, Wet, Wet. And I went, yes, it is. She went, no, it's no. Where's Marty? And I went, there he is there. So this guy at the back sort of stood it and started waving at her. She went, that's no Marty. I went, it is Marty. She went, well, it doesn't look like Marty. I said, well, it is Marty. And she went, sing something. And you think I'm making this up? The ball boy went, I feel it in my fingers. I feel it in my toes. She went, aye, it is Marty, come in. And we got our dinner. So I wrote the piece in the paper saying that this was the moment that Wet, Wet, Wet had to sing for their supper. So we, and unless he sung Love Is All Around, we weren't getting in. It was as simple as that.
That's so funny. I love that. Now, music is obviously your thing in such a way that reading is my thing.
Yeah.
Were you a big reader as a kid growing up?
Yeah, but it was just what you were reading. When you were a kid growing up, my mother... And I remember this vividly. We lived in a tenement flat in Townhead in Glasgow, a room and kitchen. When you think of it, it was positively Dickensian, no running, no hot water, no central heating, no fridge, no washing machine, no phone. The toilet was on the landing outside the house. So if you went down to go to the toilet and the neighbour was in it, you had to wait till they finished and come back again. So, it wasn't a plush, let's just say that. But, everybody was in the same boat and, you know, you never felt you were being deprived in any way. But my mother, she was a great listener to what was called the wireless then. It wasn't called the radio. She would mm-hmm. listen to the wireless, the BBC Light programme. And she also was quite an avid reader. So she had a subscription to Reader's Digest. And every month, this little book would come through the post and she would read it and leave it lying about. And, you know, it was stories about, you know, wildlife and stories about, you know, historical figures, and they would have little jokey bits in it. And I used to read it and it was fascinating. So that was, you know, some of my earliest memories of, you know, book reading, for want of a better term. But of course, you were a kid and we lived in number 30 Martyr Street in Town Head, and right on the corner, there was a newsagent, Huey's newsagent, a guy called Huey Templeton. And about the second week in November, we used to wait for it every year. One of the windows of his newsagent shop, he would clear the window and then he would put all the annuals that were coming out for Christmas. So you would look, you know, with your nose pressed up against the window mm-hmm. and there would be the Beano, the Dandy, the Topper, the Beezer, the Victor, the Rover. And you would think, right, you know, what annuals am I going to ask Santa for my Christmas? So I was a big reader of annuals. So I would read the Bruins book, the Oor Willie book. I would read the Beano. I would read the Victor. I would also read the James Bond album in 1964 when Goldfinger came out. They put out a James Bond, you know, annual with him, 007 Sean Connery on the front with his gun. And I bought that and I still have it to this day, and it's in great condition because I'm a bit kind of, you know, anal when it comes to sort of keeping things good. So, you know, I would read all things like that. And then recently, you'll be too young to know what I'm even talking about, so will half of your listeners, but there was a programme that used to be on every lunchtime on STV called The 1 o'clock Gang. And it was a kind of variety programme. And it was really cheesy and really sort of cheap and nasty, but it was a famous programmer. I think it ran from the late 50s right into the early 60s. And, you know, it was presented by a guy called Larry Marshall. And there was also a guy called Jimmy Nairn, who was a kind of comedian, who was the father of Nick Nairn, famous TV chef, yeah. And Charlie Sim and Dorothy Paul, who went on to be a success. So you would run home from school to watch the 1 o'clock Gang, and then it was really frustrating because you couldn't watch the last 15 minutes because you had to leave to go back to school. And recently, you know, I saw on eBay that they were selling a 1 o'clock Gang annual dating back to 1960. And for some reason, it was being sold in a bookshop in Australia.
Wow.
And I sent my money away and the woman packaged it up and sent it through the post. And so, but I kept all my annuals. And the other books I had when I was a kid was I was always pretty good at school. I was always maybe first or second in the class. Mm-hmm. So I've got all my prizes, you know, from the end of year prize given for general excellence presented to Billy Sloan. And then, you know, I was in the Sunday school of the Life Boys before I joined the Boys Brigade. Mm-hmm. And you would get your end of term, you know, prize. So mm-hmm. I kept all my books. I'm a bit kind of sentimental when it comes to things like that. So I've got them all on the shelf at home. I've probably no read half of them, but I've still got them all. And, you know, they're kind of prized possessions. They're a part of my life and I want to keep hold of them.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember being at school. I went to Garsherry Primary School in Coatbridge, and every year, like you did, we would have, you know, a merit prize mm-hmm. and you would win a book.
Yeah.
And it would be a beautiful book. It would be something like Robert Louis Stevenson. Uh-huh. It would be leather bound and have gold foil. And, you know, it became an ornament because yeah. it was too nice to read.
Of course.
When you're talking about keeping things good, I think that was a thing that we all did.
And
back
it's funny how you say that, you know, because the people who listen to your programme will be real book fans and they'll be horrified at my attitude to books. I mean, I buy books and I don't actually read them. I barely open them. I kind of open them just a fraction so that I don't crack the spine. And then I put them away, you know. So people say to me, you know, what are you buying books for that you don't read? But I just like having them. And I've got quite a collection. I collect the Taschen and the Genesis publications, large format books, mm-hmm. you know, and I've got quite a few of them. And they're quite valuable now. And I mean, I never bought them with the idea of trying to monetize them. I just bought them because I loved them. And the jewel in the crown is I bought a book. This is maybe going back, I'm guessing, maybe 20, 25 years. And I was sitting in the office one day, and Jules Gizzy, the guitar player from Gunn, who you'll know.
Yes.
He used to run a bistro up in Cambridge Street. He went, there's a guy just came in the bistro. He's a book rep for Tashin Books.
Oh.
And they're bringing a book out about Muhammad Ali. Now, as I'll tell you later, I'm a huge boxing fan. And they brought out this book called GOAT, which stands for Greatest of All Time. And it's a sumo book, what they call a sumo book. So it's maybe about 3.5 feet square. And it's maybe about, 18 inches deep. It weighs 5 stone.
Oh, my goodness.
And I bought the book, and it's basically, a photo book about Muhammad Ali, the boxer. And I bought one, and it arrived, and it was so heavy I could hardly lift it. I was going to put it up on a shelf in the cupboard in the house, and I couldn't lift it. So it's now in a storage unit, my storage unit in the centre of Glasgow. And I bought it about 25 years ago. I think I paid something like, 1,200 quid for it, which is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to buy one now, they're pretty collectible. You're talking about $4,000-$4,500. But I'm never going to sell it. But I've never opened it. It's still in the black, cellophane in the packaging. Now, for all I know, it could be a big block of wood or a block of lead weight or something. I'm just hoping that if I ever get around to opening it, I can, confirm that it is, in fact, that book. But what Tashin do is they bring these large format books out, and then they bring kind of cheaper versions, smaller versions of them. So I've got the smaller version of the Muhammad Ali book as well. So I've got that. I've got, some David Bowie books from Genesis Publications. I've got Speed of Life, that it was a photo book that he did with a Japanese photographer called Sukita. And I also got a book called Station to Station that he did with a guy called Jeff McCormick, which was his travels through Europe on the, the Orient Express and the Trans-Siberian Express, because he doesn't like flying, so he would get the train from gig to gig. And they're signed by David Bowie. So,
wow.
Sadly, when he passed away in 2016, that made them even more valuable. But I just love things like that. I mean, I bought one recently. It was a book that Genesis put out on the Faces, the band The Faces. And it was signed by Ronnie Wood, and it was signed by Ian McLagan, and it was signed by Kenny Jones, the drummer. Sadly, it wasn't signed by Ronnie Lane because he died many years before. But I don't think Rod Stewart was involved in it. It was just the three of them, Ronnie Wood and guitar, Ian McLagan and keyboards, and Kenny Jones and drums. And when I was interviewing Rod Stewart, last year, I took the book down and I got him to sign it.
Wow.
So I've probably got the only copy of that Genesis book with 4 of the 5 members of The Faces. Nobody's going to get the late, great Ronnie Lane, sadly. But, Rod Stewart wrote on it. Rod Stewart, lead singer, he wrote on it. So I've got 4 out of the 5. So, but, it's all still wrapped in the cellophane. I'll probably never open it, but I just love having it,
Well, I do know exactly what you mean, because I'm a wee bit like that with vintage clothing.
Yeah.
Like things that will never fit me, things that I will never wear, but
yeah.
I love looking at it. It makes me happy. And I think when you support an author, whether you read the book or not, I think by the sheer act of buying that book, you've supported them.
And I mean, there's an... I'm a real collector, as you know. I mean, I've got, every autograph, every photograph, every set list, every ticket stub, every pass of every gig that I've ever went to, right? And I don't know what I'm going to do with them. I'm going to try and have to get them in some kind of order. But, there's a book coming out at the moment in Genesis Publications about Buddy Holly that's been put together by Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend of The Who, and they've signed it, and there's all sorts of various different versions. And I'm tempted, but, it's a lot of money, and, I'm trying to stop buying stuff because it's just getting too nuts. But I love books. And I mean, I know in the modern era that we're in, people go travelling and they sit there with their Kindle and all that kind of stuff, and they've got 20 books on it, and they go on holiday and they read 20 books when they're on holiday. Call me old fashioned, but I don't want a Kindle. I'm a bit of a technophobe. I'd rather have a book with a bookmark and the actual book. Because when I was a kid in Townhead, I used to go down every Saturday to this bookshop in Glebe Street, just across the road from the Royal Infirmary. And I would buy Superman and Batman and Flash and DC comics. So you would read them, and then if you took them back the next week, the guy would say, right, I'll give you 10 pence for them, or I'll give you 20 pence if you get more comics. But when you walked into the bookshop, and you'll know what I'm talking about, there was a kind of smell, there was an aroma of old books.
Mm-hmm.
And you just don't get that anymore. And that's what I loved about record stores as well. You know, there was a real, and you know, it's great that people have got 20 books on their Kindle, but I would rather just, you know, if I was ever going to read 20 books on holiday, which would be a bit of a stretch, I would physically take 20 books and lug them in my case, because I want a book. I don't want to sit with a Kindle. I want the pictures, I want the cover, I want, you know, where it was printed. I want all that kind of stuff. The same way as I would do with a vinyl album. I don't stream stuff. I hate all that stuff. I'd rather have a record.
Mm-hmm. It's much more experiential when you have the physical copy, isn't it? Do you visit bookshops often or libraries? Like, do you find yourself?
I visit bookshops frequently. I mean, you know, when I wrote One Love, One Life, or the catalyst for that was that everybody had always been saying, oh, you know, you should write a book. You've got these great stories. You should write a book. And I'm not being falsely modest when I say this, but I just never thought anybody would be that interested in, you know, a book of what I'd done. But any time when I was working for the Sunday Mail and I went down to London in a job, I'm a shopper, which is unusual for a guy. Most guys wouldn't go near shop, but I'm a shopper, so I like going around the shops.
And you're the dream date.
Yeah, I'm the dream date. And one of my favourite shops was Selfridges in Oxford Street. And Selfridges in the basement have got the most brilliant book department any, you know, department store I've ever been in. You go in there and you see books that you've never seen in any other bookstore the length and breadth of the UK. So I go in and spend hours in there, not necessarily buying anything, but they've got a lot of the big Tash and large format books. And I go in and just look at the books. And I never read fictional books. I only read factual books, you know, biographies or crime books or sports books or that kind of stuff. So I spend hours in bookstores looking at that. But I was in Selfridges one day. It was 2012. And I was looking at the biography section. And I noticed that Pudsey, the dog that won Britain's Got Talent, had just released its biography, or maybe it was even an autobiography. I don't know if dogs can speak. And I thought, you know, the dog's written a book. I need to get the finger out and I read about it. So I wrote a couple of chapters. I wrote a chapter about when we went to interview Johnny Cash in London and the photographer pissed him off and he was going to kill us. And I tried to kind of retrieve the situation and only succeeded in pissing him off even more and he was really going to kill us. And then I also wrote a chapter, your listeners won't believe this, but I supported status quo at the SEC, I think it was 1997. A sellout gig in front of 8,500 people, and I was lucky to escape with my life. You know, to say that I went down like I did a DJ set, and to say that I went down like a lead balloon is underselling it. So I wrote two chapters, and then as John Lennon says, you know, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. I get sort of distracted, and then in 2022, a literary agent called Kevin Pocklington, a great guy, he said, I hear you're writing a book. And I went, no, hang on a minute, Kevin. I said, I wrote two chapters 10 years ago. I'm not writing a book. But he stuck it under the nose of a publisher in Edinburgh and they loved it. But then they had their monthly meeting where there's five people in the panel and two of them loved it, but three of them didn't. So it gets kind of outvoted. But fair play to him. He went to Black and White and they... this is great, you know, what else has he got? And of course, I never had anything. And suddenly I had to write a big proposal of what the other chapters, you know, 10 sample chapters, what the subjects would be and what the content, a little sort of synopsis of each of them. So it was all new territory for me. And then I signed a contract and I had to deliver the copy and the manuscript by the 1st of June 2023. And I'm pleased to say that in all my years in newspapers, I never missed a deadline. So they were able to get it and it's in Watson's.
Amazing. Amazing. Just to go back to, you know, your career as a music journalist, pre-internet, you were the conduit for so many of us to have access to some of the world's biggest music stars. But also when you worked in radio, you know, you were the guy that introduced so many of us to amazing Scottish bands, whether it was Lloyd Cole, The Blue Nile, The Big Dish, You and Cry. You know, there's a lot of history there, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I write about it in the book. You know, I was lucky that I got a job doing the column for the Sunday Mail. But before I did that, I worked for a paper called Clyde Guide, which was kind of like Radio Clyde's version of The List or Radio Times or something. It lasted a year and then it kind of bit the dust. But that kind of got me a foot in the door of the station. And then suddenly I got a show you know, from midnight to 2 on a Thursday night. Now, everybody thought I was sitting with some kind of crystal ball, you know, looking in saying, I am going to make this band stars, you know, like some kind of rock and roll version of Mystic Meg. It was nothing like that at all. I didn't even know what I was doing. But I just took in a bundle of my favourite records and I played them. And I thought, I love these records. Maybe somebody else might quite like them as well. And I was amazed at the response, because apart from, you know, David Jensen and Radio 1 and John Peel and Radio 1 and Johnny Walker and Alan Freeman, there wasn't another show like mine north of the border. Mm-hmm. So for quite a number of years, it was the kind of one-stop shop. So I was playing, you know, just at that period where we were going from 1979 into 1980, when there was this incredible Scottish explosion, which sadly I don't think I'll ever be replicated. But, you know, I was playing the Skids, Big Country, Simple Minds, Aztec Camera, Orange Juice, Joseph K., the Blue Nile, the Associates, all these kind of... But I was also playing Susie and the Banshees, U2, you know, all these bands, you know, Elvis Costello, David Bowie, that kind of stuff. So nobody else was playing that. And it was great. You know, we were kind of learning on the job. I didn't even have a clue what I was doing. A lot of people would still say that... I still to this day don't have a clue what I was doing, but it was exciting because, you know, the bands were learning on the job. I was learning on the job, and it was great fun. It was a real kind of exciting period. And then, you know, writing stuff in the paper, you know, I mean, I get hired by the Daily Record on the 14th of February, 1983, Valentine's Day. And it was the first time that a Scottish newspaper had a dedicated music writer. I mean, the Daily Record had... writers who specialise in politics, sport,
motoring.
Fashion, motoring, industry, you know, health, all that kind of stuff. But they didn't have a music writer until I came along, and suddenly I was writing about, you know, guys with long hair who played the guitar. So, you know, a lot of the old timers in the paper were like, looked down their nose at you a wee bit because, you know, you're not writing about normal, proper things. But, you know, the rest is history. You know, I was there for something like 33 years. It was amazing.
Sometimes I think in certain circles there's inverted snobbery about
of course there
what
is.
You're writing
yeah.
about, what your background is, you know, did you study journalism, did you know?
But I mean, I had a great editor. The guy at the Record was a guy called Bernie Vickers. He was a Mancunian and he was great. I just loved him. I absolutely adored him. And right at the start, you know, talk about pressure, he billed me right from the start as Scotland's number one pop writer. Now, he'd have been more accurate billing me as Scotland's only pop writer because there wasn't anybody else doing it, right? But, you know, I went from writing one story a week in the Sunday Mail to maybe writing four or five stories in a week for the Daily Record. So it was like spinning plates. And he said right from the start that, you know, if you go to interview somebody like, say, Mick Jagger, you know, you can't get near him. He's got managers, he's got record company people, he's got publicists, he's got minders, he's got, you know, personal assistants, right? So when you pick up a paper in 2024 and it says Joe Bloggs talks to Mick Jagger, you've got to ask yourself the question, did he actually talk to Mick Jagger, or did he get a press release and some quotes from the internet and some PR sentiment through and he's cobbled something together? So Bernie wanted me to get a photograph taken. If I was going to interview Mick Jagger or Paul McCartney or David Bowie or Elton John or Rod Stewart or Tina Turner or Diana Ross or Dolly Parton or, you know, Peter Gabriel or Kylie Minogue, is that enough name dropping
yeah,
for you?
Yeah, right? I was just about to say.
I wasn't even breathing heavy there, you know, got all these names. But if I was going to interview any of these people, he wanted me to get a picture with me and Mick Jagger, because that proved that when we said the Daily Record talks to Mick Jagger, I talked to him. And he also wanted to show that while you couldn't get near any of these guys, our guy could. And the other thing was as I was a fan, and I'm still a fan, I thought, you know, you might only get one chance in your life to interview Mick Jagger. Luckily, I've had three. But our one chance in your life to interview Paul McCartney, luckily, I've had four occasions when I've done that. You would be insane not to have some kind of record of it. And I would always ask them for their autograph and they'd say, who's it for? Expecting you to say, it's for my next door neighbour's pal's wee sister's paper boy's cousin. And I'd say, no, it's for me. And they would look at you because the London guys never did that.
Yeah. Well, it was deemed uncool.
Aye, well, they were too. They thought they were bigger stars than the stars they were interviewing.
Absolutely.
So I've got a big collection of all these pictures that I'll need to try and get sorted out and yeah. autographs. But, you know, I'm a fan. So the book was written from the point of view, I mean, being a journalist and a broadcaster for the last 45 years gave me the machinery to do it. But it's very much, and I hope it comes across, a book written by a fan.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, I mean, I shared an office with a guy, and when we were arguing, he said, "Oh, you know, your problem, you know, you're nothing but a fan with a typewriter." And he meant that as the ultimate put down. But I took that as being the greatest compliment he could pay me, because when you stop being a fan, you should just stop.
Absolutely, I agree. And it's so evident when you read the book, which, by the way, you can pick up and read a chapter and then not pick it up for 2 weeks and go back to it. And,
yeah, it's,
you know,
pretty self-contained. It's,
yeah, you don't need to invest a huge amount of time in it. And I think that's the beauty of it. You know, you can keep it by your bedside and pick up a chapter and read it when you like. But it's so evident that you are absolutely in love with what you do.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, as I say, I only read factual books. I read a lot of music books, and some of my favourites would be, there was a great book I got, I think it would be back in the early 70s, called The Longest Cocktail Party by a guy called Richard DeLello. And he started off as the kind of tea boy at Apple Records, you know, the Beatles record company at number 3 Savile Row in the West End of London. And then he kind of worked his way up, you know, up through the ranks. And he basically wrote a book called The Longest Cocktail Party about the madness that went on in Apple when the Beatles had started this big kind of multi-faceted company that was going to release records and books and artworks and stage comp, you know, exhibitions and all this kind of stuff. And then, of course, it lasted for a few years and then it went completely pear-shaped. And at one point, Liam Gallagher had actually optioned the movie rights for the book. I don't know what happened to it, but it's a fascinating book about just how crazy it was. I mean, there was an incident in it where George Harrison was in America and he met these Hell's Angels. And he says, you know, if you're ever in London, you know, pop in and see us, look me up.
Come in
never,
for a
never in a million years thinking. And about 4 months later, you know, 20 Hell's Angels came over from America with their bikes and the leather gear. And they basically came into Apple and lived there for the next 6 weeks. They couldn't get rid of them. So that's a great book. There's what other books have I got? There's a good guy in Scotland called Ken McNabb. He used to work for both the Herald and the Evening Times, and he's a bit of a Beatle freak as I am. And he wrote a book called The Beatles in Scotland, which was all the links that the Beatles had with everything north of the border. The cover of it's brilliant because there's a picture of John, Paul, George and Ringo, you know, with the polo necks and the black suits, standing at the Welcome to Scotland sign that's down on the border, yeah, right? Yeah. And, you know, it's a great book. I serialised it for the Sunday Mail. We did the serialisation. And it's brilliant because, you know, John Lennon had a lot of Scottish relatives. So when he was a kid, he would come up here as a wee boy and go and stay with his uncle Peter, whatever his name was, in Arbroath. And he loved Scotland. It tells the story of the Beatles playing their first ever gig in Scotland, which was Alloa Town Hall on the 20th of May, 1960. When they were known as the Silver Beatles, B-E-E-T-L-E-S. They hadn't changed the E to the A by that time. They were known as the Silver Beatles, and they were the backing band for a guy called Johnny Gentle, who was a singer from Liverpool, for where they came from, of course. And they played their first ever gig as Johnny Gentle's backing band. And when I interviewed McCartney most recently in 2018, he says, when we got to Alloa Town Hall, he says, the kids were going crazy, he says, but they didn't even know who we were. He says, they didn't even know who Johnny Gentle was. And Paul McCartney, to make himself sound a bit more exotic and sexy, changed his name to Paul Ramon, R-A-M-O-N. And George Harrison changed his name to Carol Harrison because he was a big fan of Carol Perkins. John Lennon refused point blank to change his name. He just stuck with John Lennon. And, you know, so it's all wee great stuff. And Ken's written 3 books on the Beatles. He's got one out at the moment called Shaken Up Baby, which is in bookstores right now, and it's great. But he also wrote another book called And in the End, which was, you know, the story of the final year of the Beatles' life and career from 1969, right? And he did it like January, February, March, right through to December. Now, you always think, you know, with a Beatles book, what can I read about the Beatles that I've never read, you know, 100 times previously? But Ken always comes up with these wee nuggets of information. I don't know how he manages to find the people and the eyewitnesses. But, you know, that's another one of my favourite. And then there's another great book called David Bowie, A Life, written by a guy called Dylan Jones, who I think is the editor of GQ.
GQ, yes.
And he wrote this big, thick, it was like 750 pages. On, you know, David Bowie, all the sort of various incidents in his career, from splitting up the Spiders from Mars to going to America and becoming a soul star. And what he did was, the way he wrote it was really clever because he got people who were kind of he interviewed 180 people who were eyewitnesses to specific events in Bowie's life. And then he would tee the event up, whatever it was, if he was meeting young Americans in Philadelphia with all the soul singers and Luther Vandross. He would then ask, you know, the various people what their recollections of it. It was a great book. So I like books like that. And another one of my favourites I've got to mention is a great book called Tearing Down the Walls of Sound, which was written by a great writer for The Guardian, a guy called Mick Brown. And it was a biography of Phil Spector, the record producer. And it was unputdownable. I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. You know, he goes out to Phil Spector's mansion in the outskirts of Hollywood. He goes to interview him in Hollywood, and the interview's supposed to be for Tuesday, but then, no, we can't do it on Tuesday, it'll be Thursday now. No, we can't do it on Thursday, it'll be next Monday. So he's been sat there for 2 weeks thinking, I'm never going to get this. And then suddenly he gets a phone call saying, right, Mr. Spector will see you. So they send a chauffeur-driven, you know, limousine to pick him up. And the guy drives him up to a place called Alhambra, which is a kind of rough area in the outskirts of Hollywood with all these kind of scrapyards and strip clubs and, you know, car rental lots and that kind of stuff. And they drive through the gates. It's a big sort of gated compound with this big sort of mansion, Spanish-style mansion up in the hill. And they drive through the gates and the guy stops the car and says, could you just walk up to the house from here? It's about, you know, 200 yards up the driveway to the front door. And he says, are you not going to run me up with the door? And he went, no, he says, Mr. Spector likes to see guests arriving. And as he was walking up, Phil Spector was up keeking out the curtains. And then he sat in the place for about 4 hours waiting for Phil Spector. And there was pipe music being played in all the rooms. And then right on cue, after a 4 hour wait, some big, you know, piece of classical music, you know, gets blasted through the speakers. And Phil walks down with the toupee and the, you know, the velvet, you know, dressing gown, the velvet monogram slippers and stuff. And he interviews Phil Spector. And then, you know, after a while, they had a wee bit of lunch and Phil Spector disappeared. And he was left sitting there for another 4 hours. And when he said to the PA, what's this? Well, Mr. Spector has to take his medication. And the book is just absolutely fantastic. So, I mean, I like reading music books like that, and I've got quite a big collection of them.
You've written a few books for people in the music industry, haven't you? So you've worked with Simple Minds.
It was not books exactly, but you know, if they were bringing an album out and they needed notes for it, I did New Gold Dream, Simple Minds, and that was, I mean, that was a fair old chunk of work. That it was something like about maybe 20,000 words, and it turned out great. Also, did Hue and Cry decided to repackage their Remote album, which was their biggest, most famous record. And you got the box set with all the outtakes and the demos and, you know, archive stuff that you'd never heard before. And I interviewed Pat Kane and Greg Kane separately and, you know, wrote that. And even though I say so myself, it turned out great because the story was just so interesting, as was New Gold Dream. And then the other one I did was Wet, 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 popped in, sold out. Mm-hmm. So I had to interview Marty Pelo, Tommy Cunningham, the drummer, Graham Clark, the bass player, and Neil Mitchell, the keyboard player, separately. And I mean, the only problem with that is if you interview Tommy Cunningham for 2 hours, you've then got to sit and transcribe the tapes. It's really time-consuming. But I interviewed them all, and I went out to Clydebank High School where they'd all met up when they were at school, and I had a wee look around there, and the janitor let me in one day to see where the classroom was and all that kind of stuff. And so I did that, and it turned out great. And the reason it turned out great was, you know, nothing to do with me. It was because their story was so amazing. You know, four young boys in a school in Clydebank, you know, no job prospects, you know, nothing to look forward to. And then suddenly 3 years later, they're playing Madison Square Garden with Elton John, and then they have three number one hits. I mean, it's like beyond your wildest dreams. And I also did another one for Cliff Richard, which was called The Rock and Roll Years, and it was a kind of box set of every record he'd made between the years of 1957 to 1962. And in that 5 year period, he was kind of the British answer to Elvis Presley.
Absolutely.
And I had to, they sent me a fax. Remember, we used to get faxes? They sent me a fax, Cliff Richard headed notepaper fax, with all the people that I should contact. And it took me months to contact them all. And then I had to go down to Birmingham and interview Cliff one day in the dressing room when he was on tour. And it turned out great as well because the story was just so fascinating. Now, you know, with the best will in the world, You ain't going to get that with Kasabian. You ain't going to get that with Ed Sheeran. You ain't going to get that with a lot of the sort of modern so-called pop stars because they've got nothing to say.
It's interesting that the, you know, just the nostalgia of it, because I remember watching Blue Peter and seeing Wet, Wet, Wet.
Yeah.
And screaming at the TV because they were Scottish, and it was the same. You know, I'm from Coatbridge. It's just where Hugh and Cry were from. And you saw them on Top of the Pops and you were just like, wow, they're from my hometown. And it gave you a sense that you could dream big.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of my favourite examples in the book was, you know, I used to DJ in a place called Night Moves in Sucky Hall Street, which is right next door to Lauder's Pub. There was a fire there several years ago and it got demolished. Lauder's still exists, but the building that Night Moves in. And I DJed in there on a Friday night. And this guy came up to me one night and he said, you know, I'm in a band, we're the best new band in Scotland, and, you know, here's my tape. And what marked him out from everybody else who was doing that was that he had an English accent. He was from Derbyshire, he wasn't a local. And he says, I've got this great band called The Casuals. I hope you like your tape. So I took it back and it was a song called The Power of Love. And I thought, this is fantastic. So I played it about 4, 5, 6 weeks in a row of the programme. He phoned up his manager who was on a gap year, you know, hitchhiking around, his pal rather, who was hitchhiking around Europe when I got here, and he said, look, you know, you need to come back. You know, this guy, Billy Sloan's playing my record on the radio and I don't know what to do. And all these record companies are phoning me up and I'm just, you know, I'm getting snowed under, I'm getting stressed. So his pal was a guy called Derek McKillop and he came back and became his manager. And they changed the name of the band from The Casuals to The Commotions. And Lloyd Cole and The Commotions get signed by Polydor Records on the strength of me playing their demo. And then a few months later, they were on Top of the Pops with Perfect Skin. So, I mean, you're sitting there on a Thursday night, you know, on Top of the Pops going, and you're punching the air. It was the same with Simple Minds. You know, for years, I would be ranting on in the radio and ranting on in the paper about how great a band Simple Minds were. Nobody was bothering their shirt. And then Promised You a Miracle went into the singles charts. And you know, and you would like to think that the people in the Daily Record would come up and go, fair dues.
Fair dues, well
you know,
done.
Fair dues, well done. You know, you spotted them 5 years ago, but we'd never heard them. But of course, they never ever do that. So, you know, while it was a thrill for the bands, and it was also a thrill for me because it was kind of vindication that, you know, you weren't talking a lot of nonsense.
Yeah. I think it's so important that people high five, literally or metaphorically, and acknowledge when people have done well. Like if I read an article that points me in the direction of a brilliant new book or a new band or a film, I'm always like, thanks so much. Or you, it's important to show appreciation, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, I read a lot of sports books as well. And if you were to put me on the spot and say, what would be your desert island book?
Yes,
you
know, please.
The one and only book that you could take to a desert island. It would be a great book written by a guy called Thomas Hauser. Now, Thomas Hauser was a New York lawyer, but he was like me, he was a big boxing fan. And he wrote a book, you know, I'm going back 20, 30 years ago, called The Black Lights, about boxing. It was a fantastic book, absolutely incredible, right? And it was read by Muhammad Ali. And Muhammad Ali got in touch with him and said, look, I've read your book, I really love it. I want you to write my book. So Thomas Hauser said, look, you know, what's the point? You know, because there's been quite a high-profile Muhammad Ali biography that had come out in the 70s by a guy called Richard Durham, called The Greatest. And it was a good book, but it was a kind of safe, for want of a better term. So Thomas Hauser said, look, I'm only prepared to do this if it's warts and all. And Ali said, I wouldn't do it any other way. So Muhammad Ali then got in touch with everybody that he knew in his entourage and all his friends and all his hangers-on and all that kind of stuff and said, look, if you get contacted by a guy called Thomas Hauser, tell him whatever he wants to know, even if it's something that you don't think I'll like. So Thomas Hauser does this incredible biography of arguably the greatest sportsman of all time. And it's just, I mean, I've read it about 4 or 5 times and it's just absolutely fantastic. You read things in that that you never read anywhere else. And, you know, as a big boxing fan, I buy boxing books. There's another great one that I've got in my collection called The Fight by Norman Mailer. And he went to the Rumble in the Jungle in 1974 when Muhammad Ali fought George Foreman. George Foreman was the heavyweight champion and Muhammad Ali was challenging him for the title. And nobody thought that Muhammad Ali had an earthly chance of beating George. He was too big. He was much younger. He was too strong. He'd slaughtered both Ken Norton and Joe Frazier. I mean, one of the times he fought Joe Frazier, he punched him and the force of the punch lifted him off the ring. Oof. You actually saw him going up in the air. And nobody, apart from Muhammad Ali and Muhammad Ali's manager, Angelo Dundee, thought that he'd a hope in hell of beating George Foreman. And Norman Mailer writes a book about going to Zaire, which was pretty unusual in itself. And it's just brilliant, you know, some of the background of the stories that he tell you. It's amazing because, you know, the guy's a craftsman. And that book was also, that classic fight was also covered in another group. It was a kind of compendium. It was called Hugh McIlvany on Boxing. McIlvany on Boxing was the name of the book. He did one called McIlvany on Football, but the boxing one's my favourite. And I mean, Hugh McIlvany was the boss when it came to boxing writing in the United Kingdom. And, you know, there's great, he wrote, it's just sort of different chapters about different boxers and different incidents. And he writes about this boxer called Johnny Owen, who was a Welsh boxer. And he got injured in the ring and sadly died from his injuries. And he says, I mean, just people don't write like this anymore. He says, and he's talking about Johnny Owen here, he says, it is his tragedy that he found himself articulate in such a dangerous language. I mean, that's just, you know, I'm getting goosebumps just reading it out to you. And then when he was talking about the rumble in the jungle with Ali and Foreman in Zaire in 1974, there was a great line in it, which I've got in front of me, where he says, I know how to beat George Foreman, but it involves shelling him for a week, then sending in the infantry. I mean, you know, these guys were craftsmen, and you read, you know, their viewpoint on arguably one of the greatest, if not the greatest, sporting occasions of all time. It's magnificent, absolutely fantastic.
Billy Sloan, thank you so much. That was awesome.
Thank you, Heather. Thank you for having me on the programme. I really appreciate it. It's always lovely to see you.
Will you come back?
If I'm allowed.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please take 30 seconds to rate, review and subscribe. It really helps. New episodes drop every Thursday. Thanks so much for listening.